to another recording. Today I'm recording episode 153 on the channel. I want to wish everybody a happy new year. Today is January 2nd. And today I have the honor and distinct pleasure to have with me Henry O'Connell. Henry joined me from Utah, and we'll let Henry introduce himself in a second. Henry, as we say on this channel, everybody's got a story. So let's start with this, the easy one. Well, first, welcome to the channel. I really appreciate your time with me today. And let's get going by telling us your story.
Well, thank you so much, Robin. And it's a pleasure to be here. So I'm speaking with you about Canary Speech. And I'm the co-founder and CEO of Canary Speech. My partner, Jeff Adams, and I founded the company in a conversation in a bagel shop 9 years ago. And, you know, those kind of things. He was here in town. He was speaking. He was an alumnus of Brigham Young University. He was there speaking. He had finished up his most previous project. He led the team that built the Amazon Echo. I mean, just a tremendous work, Farfield Speech. But Jeff had been a contributor for 35 years before that to speech and language. Worked with Ray Kurzweil to develop natural language processing. 10 years before that, Jeff and I met. Maybe 8 years before that, Jeff and I met. I was at the NIH and Jeff was at the NSA. So about 38 years ago, maybe 40 years ago now, Jeff and I met working, really both of us, our first jobs after graduate school and graduate work that we did. I mean, I work constantly, but I mean, my first actually real job. Jeff was working at the NSA building mathematical models to de-encrypt spy messages. I was working in the neurology group doing research in neurological diseases. Went on to a business career. The last 20 years before that bagel shop, I had been doing corporate turnarounds. I would go in and distress companies and as an interim seat. I'm sitting there in this bagel shop with Jeff and realized that, and I'd known him all his life, but I realized while I'm looking at this man, he had created most of the significant speech and language technologies that existed to that moment. You know, speech to text for legal, speech to text for clinical notes, first products that were commercially available in either of those spots. He had developed the code that we know as Siri today. It has been advanced and revised multiple times as they do. But then Amazon looking for a team to build the Amazon Echo, you know, the thing that is so ubiquitous around the world, they simply bought the company Jeff was in about 4 years before that, you know. And so Jeff is sitting there and we're talking about different things that we could at our age at the time. I was 62 then and Jeff was a couple of years younger than me. But we were at a point where we could more functionally choose what we wanted to do, you know. And I finally got to a point about an hour into the conversation. I said, Jeff, you know, you've done so many things in the speech and language area. I mean, just amazing things. First ever. Things that never existed before, multiple times. What's left on the table? What do you want to do? I mean, where do you want to go from here? Because someone as brilliant as you, with the accomplishments you've already had, let's go do what you want to do. And he said, well, I always wanted to use speech and language to analyze for human condition and disease. And I said, well, why don't we do that? And so that's what created or started the idea of Canary Speech. We're 23 patents issued now, 16 pending patents. The technology didn't exist at the time to have a commercial, practical product in the speech space. People had pursued it, trying to use natural language processing, word-based analysis, and there's a whole bunch of reasons, and it's so easy when you're looking backwards. It's simple to say, yeah, that's not going to work. But the truth is, an NLP approach to clinical analysis in a practical way is just never going to work. And so we're sitting in that bagel shop, and Jeff is describing, it turned into 8 hours of meeting and a wonderful time with Jeff. He's describing everything over the last 35 years. I mean, because he's honestly a genius in the area. And so he's describing all of that, and I'm just listening. And I thought, well, Jeff, you know my daughter, Caitlin, my oldest. My wife and I have 5 children. I said, when she would come home from high school, she's married now. She has a child 9 years ago. This is true. But when she would come home from high school, and I'd watch her come across the room, I'm in the kitchen, I'm working, you know, like we do. I could tell from her gait whether it was a good or bad day. I mean, just a strut, you know. Every parent knows this. And when she would turn and look at me, I mean, whew, I would say to her what every parent says. And I would get the same answer every parent gets. I would say, honey, how's your day? And she would say, it's fine, and keep going, you know? And I would go, no, time out, come on, okay, come back, you know? And we would talk about her day, you know, whether it was soccer practice, whether it was a chemistry exam, whether it was anything, you know, what it was. And I said to Jeff, I said, my daughter's married now. She's not living with us and she's out of home. And not my best day. She has her first child. Wonderful thing, actually. And when I call her, and I'll admit I call her at least twice a week, when I call her and it's irritatingly accurate, I know whether it's a good day or a bad day. It has nothing to do with the words she's speaking. I can't see the physical cues. I can't see her body language. I can't see her facial expressions. And I still know whether she's happy or she's sad or she's anxious or she's upset. I know it all. And as I said, it's irritatingly accurate. So I said to Jeff, how are we doing that? Because clinical teams do that every day. And if we could build a tool that could be in their hand that would objectively measure that, validate what they're seeing, that could be valuable to them, you know? And I'm already talking about a half a dozen different illnesses or diseases, you know? I'm reading my daughter. I'm reading as we do our children. And they do that with their patients. And he said, I don't know how we do that. And I said, well, we're using the same machine learning tool, maybe a better one, but we have one. Can we use machine learning to do this? And that started the journey. That's where it started.
So the company that you've created, Canary Speech, is it a one product? You mentioned several patents. So what is the flagship, I guess? And sure. What are the other patents that you can talk about, we cannot talk about?
I can talk about anything almost. They're applied for or they're issued. We took a different approach than all the other companies did. Most of the other companies chose a disease and tried to build a correlation with language to that disease. We said the industry, clinical industry, needs a set of tools and a platform on which they could do this. That platform should run the whole gamut. It should have the data security, data integrity. It should have the tools, what are called APIs and interfaces. It should do it in a practical way, whatever practical became, you know? And I can tell you what practical is today because we've commercialized it with many institutions. But we didn't focus on a disease, but rather on the tools that could analyze for a disease. And we made the determination, even in the bagel shop that day, that we would be a clinical product. So that meant all the requirements and responsibilities that go with that. And there's a whole range of them, but we weren't your young chickens anymore. So we knew some of the responsibilities, you know? And so today we offer analysis for approximately a dozen different diseases. We're building 12 more that will launch this year. But things like progressive neurological diseases, things like Huntington's, Parkinson's, and MS, in that same vein, but what we call cognitive illnesses, things mild cognitive impairment, often called MCI, Alzheimer's disease. We also have commercialized that. And then in behavioral health, we have anxiety, depression, a behavioral health model that does a general assessment. And then we're adding PTSD and postpartum depression to that model. And then there is a range of models that will be out this year for ADHD and autism, as well as behavioral health for children. And then there's a series of models that are practical and provide information during the clinical assessment, things like an assessment for pain. Normally we say, tell me what your pain level is, 1 to 10. We actually assess that in an objective way. And then an aggression model, which provides an awareness of dangerous situations for nurses, you know. And then along the way, there's specific diseases that we're addressing, but there are insurance in the US, insurance CPT codes that reimburse for that as a clinical decision support tool. We also had to make it practical. How can you put it into the hand of a clinical team member in a practical way that doesn't disturb the relationship, but is non-intrusive in it? And so we developed what we call ambient listening. We call it Canary Ambient. We do real-time streaming and a multi-mode analysis. And we could process, of the diseases that I mentioned, we could process any of them on 40 seconds, or we can process all of them 40 seconds. So we give back information while the doctor and patient are still talking. We give back information on any of those diseases. What is the behavioral health? What is the cognitive health? While they're still talking to each other. And that information is clinical decision support. So it's part of the array of information a doctor has, their experience, the to other tests they're doing, their conversation, their questions, how they're answering them, their observations, just like we do with our children. But now they also have an objective measurement based on vocal biomarkers. And they look at that, and that may steer the next question, or it may help them formulate what they decide that the diagnosis is. So that's how Canary Speech pursued it. There are several companies in Toronto. There was a company that pursued Alzheimer's disease. In California, there were two companies that pursued just behavioral health, and they pursued it differently than we did. We use conversational speech only. Mm-hmm. So we could be doing an assessment in this meeting from words that I'm speaking, you know, and it doesn't matter what those words are. Most of the other players followed kind of speech pathology, which was a very structured analysis for a good purpose. You know, you had a deficit in your speaking, CHs or SHs or whatever it is, and they give you a paragraph that challenges you to say those things, and they can identify where the deficits are.
That's right.
But that uses a different part of the brain and behavioral health. And so by doing that structured speech, you're actually not helping yourself. So we use just conversation. Conversation's happening between a doctor and a patient. We're listening to that conversation. We're separating those voices. We're identifying them. We're doing quality assurance along the way. And then feature extraction. We look at 2,590 different features every 10 milliseconds, all below the word level.
So are these solutions, are they networked together? Can you take advantage of them? Or is it on from a training perspective for the models? Or are they centralized per hospital, per doctor, per clinic? I don't know how you have it distributed.
So wherever a conversation between a doctor and patient is occurring. So for instance, in the Microsoft Dragon Copilot platform, they're doing clinical dictation notes for a doctor. So while the doctor and patient are talking, they're listening to the, in an informed consent, they're listening to the patient and they're listening to the doctor, and they're creating notes for both of them. Accurate, very accurate notes. Mm-hmm. They're also providing them with other information. What we do is we're fully integrated into the Microsoft Dragon Copilot. We're fully integrated into that. And what we do is simply listen to that same conversation. And after 40 seconds of patient speaking, and it can be 8 seconds here and 12 seconds there and 10 seconds here, and we're intelligent enough to know when we have 40 seconds, we process it, and within milliseconds, the doctor has on their handheld device, either the Epic Haiku or on the Dragon Copilot device, they can see the scores for that whole range of diseases or whichever ones they selectively pick. So maybe it's behavioral health or postpartum depression, or maybe we're analyzing MS or Parkinson's. Mm-hmm. So we can do this as a selective group of illnesses, or you could do it like a blood profile where an individual gets an entire profile, you know, a dozen different things. By the end of next year, it'll be 24 different diseases that we analyze for. So it's what we tried to do is create something that could function in real time, that could function in a non-intrusive way. So we're not interfering with the conversation.
So you are turning human voice into diagnostic signals. And that's not incremental, to be honest with you. That's like categorical shift in the way you diagnose various diseases. So initially, 8 years ago, when you guys started, you must have set out to solve a problem in healthcare. What beside the technology is cool and it allows us to do a bunch of things and it's nice to have, etc. In your initial assessment, what was the problem in healthcare that made this what you created in Canary Speech inevitable and you have to create it?
Well, we're in a situation in a whole host of areas. You know, we had increasing behavioral health problems. We have increasing autism and ADHD problems with our children. So behavioral health is increasing in our population. We're getting in an older population, so we have reasons to assess and manage that aging process, you know, with mild cognitive impairment and Alzheimer's. And all of those things are happening at a much higher rate of growth than the number of physicians, doctors, patients, nurses. I often say we're never going to have enough doctors and nurses, so we need a force multiplier. We need to make information in the time space that they have with a patient, we need to increase the amount of information they have about that patient, enhancing their ability to make a decision about what their diagnosis is. In our case, we're a clinical decision support tool, so we're a piece of that process for them. But ultimately, a diagnosis is made by a doctor. And if you're in a primary care area and you're seeing a patient and you're trying to make an assessment about whether or not you can manage their care with you or you need to refer them to a specialist, that decision is best based on objective information and data. So you're not going to be able to have more time with them to get that information. So Canary Speech offers, without intruding on the amount of time, we can offer to provide more information and to do that while you're still with them. So you don't have to go searching for it afterwards. It wasn't taken as a subjective test half hour before you got there. All of this means working through the process and the flow between the doctor and the patient to enhance that engagement without increasing or encumbering the amount of time, because we don't have more time. Time is it. And number of patients is increasing more rapidly than the number of caregivers. So how can we make this interaction more fruitful, more valuable to both the patient and the clinician, and the referral more accurate if a referral needs to be made? That was the thought.
Absolutely. Henry, as you know, you've been at this for a while, have you measured or have kept statistics of the outcome? And how did Canary Speech impact the patient outcome, positive or negative?
So we do. We watch after that. We're rolling out with Kentucky Baptist right now with the Dragon Copilot product. And the interface into that is now been presented to many hospitals, including a few meetings in Canada. And one of the doctors was speaking about a meeting he had with a primary care doctor, a meeting he had with his patient, a woman, who 6 weeks earlier had delivered a child. Our mothers are just wonderful people, as you know. And so she's got her first infant home with her. Life-changing event, joy of her life, with a stiff upper lip, you know, the responsibility of being mom. He asked her the question, how are you doing? And she said, oh, I'm doing great. You know, things are going well, you know. It's nice to have my baby in the home, you know, and everything else. And she at the same time was being assessed by Canary Speech, and her depression levels came back as high as we could measure them. And for this doctor, it was an eye-opening experience. He said this was game-changing. It was clinically significant. It allowed me to ask a series of additional questions with a patient that I've known for many years. And we had a plan to help her with that depression before she left. Without Canary Speech, if I took her on her word, she would have gone home a terribly depressed person because she's trying to be the best mother she can. Sometimes, you know, being the best mother she can means also, you know, allowing others to help her. And in this case, her doctor, you know. So it was a wonderful thing. We see that kind of thing happening. I've seen similar things. I was in a meeting with permission, both the patient permission and the doctor's permission. I was in a meeting where a woman came in who was my age, about 72 years old, and she wasn't the patient. Her mother was. And I just thought that was so sweet, you know. And I don't know how old her mom was. But for the very first time, and they've been doing this for 20 years together, for the very first time, her mother was measured with mild cognitive impairment, a precursor to Alzheimer's disease. Now, that's a traumatic thing for anyone to hear. But for these two individuals and their doctor, who had been their doctor for 20 years, they had a plan together. They had connected them with community resources and AARP and the Alzheimer's Association before they left. And for both of them, they were leaving a new phase of this care, but mom's in her 90s now. You know, this was something this is just another thing. The love between these two people we're going to manage, you know. So those are the kind of things where Canary Speech as an objective set of information provides insight into and augments the care that they're getting.
Absolutely. This is where we talk about it quite a bit on this channel, Henry, is that AI is a assisting tool to whatever we do. In this specific case here, we're talking about AI in health and healthcare delivery, which is phenomenal. What people are worried about down the road is AI replacing human, because we're still going through a trust phase. Do we trust AI fully, or do we need to stay in control? And it sounds to me like Canary Speech is in the assisting the human, the professionals, make a decision. Now, to our audience who is not familiar with some of the terms we're using, I want to ask you, if you don't mind, what is a vocal biomarker in plain language for those of us who are not too familiar with that?
So biomarkers in general, we often think of the genome. You know, like I have alleles for green blue eyes, and anyone in the world that has that gene set, alleles they're called, But who has that gene code will have green, blue eyes. It doesn't matter where they're living. It doesn't matter. It's ubiquitous across the world, as I said earlier. So a biomarker is something that is common across. If you see it in a population in North America, and you see the same thing in a population in Japan, that's a biomarker. If it codes to the same thing. Now, words don't do that. You know, I mean, all you have to be in Canada, you can comfortably walk into areas where there's French is the dominant language, you know, and here in the US, we have multiple languages everywhere. So I look at vocal biomarkers as elements below the word level that provide a commonality across populations, regardless of where they live in the world. And that's so critical. So if I'm measuring anxiety based on not the words they're speaking, but on how the characteristics of the vocal cords are driven by the central nervous system. So the central nervous system is driving this. And when I get anxious, it drives my vocal cords more rapidly. That's common across all populations. It's even common across people who have training and who try, because it's a self-conscious thing. You're not controlling it consciously. So, and there are 2,590 of these features in speech that are not controlled consciously, that drive the articulatory system that makes speech and languages 150, 200 different languages around the world, many, many, many different languages. But the basic information that creates any of those languages is the same. And that's a vocal biomarker, something that creates the what we hear from the central nervous system controlling the tongue and the cheeks and the jaw and respiration and the vocal cords and the musculature around the vocal cords. All of that is self-conscious, objective, and that's what we're measuring.
So is this, can I say, for instance, it's language independent, so it doesn't matter what demographics, what language you speak, every human has these biomarkers, or is it by all demographic?
No, it's all the same. And I say that, but scientists don't just assume that. So we built our initial models for behavioral health in the Northeast with a range of different hospitals. Everything we do is built within a hospital environment or a clinical medical environment with a primary investigator that's a clinician and a primary investigator that's a scientist, usually the scientist on our side, the clinician on that side. So everything's built under that kind of rigor. But we took our models for behavioral health and then we tested them across all 50 states using independent clinical research groups to gather the data and across Canada and in England, Ireland, Australia, all English. And then Spanish, we did the same thing in the US, in Spain, and in South America. And we gathered all this data and we validated across different languages in different geographies to see if accents or if other issues of differences across the spoken or what we hear as language would make a difference in what we are analyzing for behavioral health. We then did the same thing for mild cognitive impairment and Alzheimer's, identically that. So multiple studies, a dozen studies, in the case of behavioral health, tens of thousands of audios captured within a clinical research framework and then tested to prove that these are sublanguage. Now, we never launch a new model in a new language without doing that validation. We're doing that in Holland right now. We're doing it in Saudi Arabia in Arabic. We're going to add 3 more languages next year minimum. And so we do that, and that takes us about 6 weeks of work. We take the algorithm that we've developed for that particular disease and we test it with a smaller group, 50 to 150 individuals. If we see any different deviation from the same level of accuracy, if there's different reasons, features that we're seeing, then we would expand that group into a broader study. We haven't seen that yet.
So one of the things we talk about, and I had a podcast here recorded last week and I published it, is medical interpretation, meaning we're trying to understand what the patient is saying and what the doctor is recommending or having a conversation with the patient. We want to make sure that this doesn't get missed. I'm assuming here what you just described to us, Henry, is that you brought it down to a common level, a common denominator level that we all understand. And it doesn't matter what language you speak. You have those characteristics, biomarkers in your vocal speech that you, doesn't matter what language you speak. You bring it down to a very common denominator, which we probably in some cases using AI probably would not require you an interpreter.
Exactly. And plus the scores we're giving them are common. So Because we develop with clinical teams as the ground truth, they create a diagnosis of a patient, in this case, multiple patients, hundreds or thousands of patients. And in a clinical trial, clinical study, they create what we call the ground truth. What is the diagnosis of the disease of that patient and the level of that disease? And we then build a vocal biomarker correlation to that and score it the same way. So the score they're seeing in real time is the score that they would normally develop. So they're seeing that score, and it's been correlated to a team of experts. And generally, what we'll work with is in progressive neurological diseases or in neurological diseases with neurologists, with behavioral diseases with psychiatrists, with childhood diseases with pediatrics and pediatric specialties. But then often it's run at the primary care level, because what we're providing the primary care doctor with is they're trying to make an assessment in an area where they have some level of expertise, but not the level of their colleagues, you know, but they have some, and they look at all the information in front of them. And part of that information is an objective measurement based on vocal biomarkers. And it doesn't matter whose hand that is in. It's not being impacted by that doctor, because we're just listening to the voice. So they see a score and they go, and maybe I ask another question and I explore it a little bit differently. I qualify that individual, and then I decide what's the next step. The doctor decides from their expertise, from a clinical standpoint, what's the next step for this patient based on this array of information I have. But we've enhanced that without intruding in the relationship and without requiring more time.
Do you monitor any other physiological exhibits, like say heart rate, et cetera, in conjunction with the vocal biomarkers that you look for?
So it's interesting. We do some multimodal analysis as well. We're going to be launching at CEX next week a new enhanced wellness assessment where we're including, I have on a Samsung watch, and the Samsung watch actually has a little canary on it. You see the little canary? You can actually do an assessment on the canary, on canary speech. You can do an assessment on their watch, but you can also capture things like how much sleep have I gotten? What is my heart and pulse rate at the time? How much activity do I have? And if you're speaking about an individual's wellness, combining that with stress and mood and anxiety and depression and other things and building a broader picture and while doing that just in the normal actions of their day. You know, they're already recording their steps. They're already recording how many hours of sleep they got. So you're combining all these elements using AI. You're enhancing the complexity, if you will, and accuracy of this algorithm. So that is something that we do. You can look at facial expressions, like I talked about with my daughter. There are technologies for looking at that, or for the looking specifically at the eyes. Both of those require. They're not as dense in information, and they require often a tool. But in our case, wherever speech is captured, we can actually analyze that speech.
So this is great, Henry. I'm getting educated as I talk to you here on something I never really got in touch with before. I never been exposed to me, or I never really studied it before. So this is great. Our audience is having fun with this episode. I can guarantee you that. The other thing that when it comes to healthcare and healthcare innovation, and healthcare solution providers comes to mind right away, and most people will be on their mind as well, is that you operate in a highly regulated industry. How do you manage that?
Well, you have to decide, and we decided in the bagel shop that that's what we were going to be. And you have to decide that you're going to function at the same level of data security, data integrity, data ethics that the hospital that you're working with does. You need to be a good partner with them. Microsoft as a partner with us and us as a partner with them, they have an extensive AI platform requirement. They have audits for AI, both AI for good and ethical AI and data security. We're high trust, we're HIPAA compliant, and we're ISO standard audited. So Canary Speech, when I go to a hospital, a few weeks ago, like I did speak with a hospital group in Toronto, I could with some pride say to them, we function at the same level for all of these things that you do, and that should be expected of us. And so that's what we do. Now, that also includes our development processes, our quality systems. We operate as a medical device company. We're registered as such. We apply for and get audited for the whole range of things I mentioned earlier. But we're also accountable for external audits by the clients that we work with, and we're good at that. So, and we should be.
Yeah, yeah. Now, let's talk a little bit about the future as we move on here. Who controls the future in terms of this particular category that you're operating in, or this business is in, that diagnostics phase? Hospital, insurers, tech companies, or the patients themselves? So who's in control here?
You know, I'm an idealist, and I like to believe that ultimately our patients control all of that. Now, there's an awful lot of infrastructure associated with this and with all that we do. The healthcare industry is a massive industry. But the actual future of healthcare and AI is truly going to be driven by, there's a regulatory element of it. And what's nice is that the most established, maybe outside of or in conjunction also with some of the financial industry, but healthcare has, you know, multiple decades of having established a framework for acting in an ethical and in a manner of integrity. So they have that framework in place. And so Canary Speech could take advantage of and become part of that, as I said earlier, a partner in that. So that's helpful. The drivers are going to be how our populations continue to grow. We're an aging population, as you know, and that's going to put different pressures, extreme pressures on our healthcare. It's going to require the use of new technologies, new assessments, new ways of doing things, new remote monitoring capabilities. I personally believe that it should not matter where a person is in the world. I don't think that should matter. I think that the quality of their healthcare shouldn't matter on the moment of their birth or the location of their birth. They should have the ability to get healthcare, if you will. One could argue if it's a right or not, I don't care. But they should have the ability to get good healthcare. And so that's all going to come down to information and data that the clinical team has, regardless of where they happen to be. And with the ability to capture audio, regardless of where you are in the world, from a smart device, and knowing that we're going to have a couple of dozen different diseases that we can assess for, accurately assess for, objectively assess for, then a clinical team can have that information, even if they happen to be, say, at Hackensack Meridian in New Jersey, and the patient happens to be in a rural area in Ireland.
You remind me of telemedicine, Henry.
Yeah, it's like telemedicine. But we're going to advance the amount of information that's available in that. We're a partner with Zoom, for instance, in their virtual care platform, also with Microsoft Teams for healthcare. So one can be having a virtual meeting, and you know how you get disconnected sometimes. You and I both have the personality where that's not a problem, you know. But first time you're meeting a doctor and it's a virtual meeting, it'd be nice for that doctor to have information that's objective. And all kinds of information can be available to them, not just vocal biomarkers, but also information, you know, relative to facial analysis and things like that that are going to enhance it. So I think the field is going to move towards that. It'll become more comfortable with that, and it'll all function within the existing framework that we have for data integrity, data ethics, and AI for good.
Do you see this becoming routine, Henry, like a blood pressure test?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And we're old enough that, and I do
my blood pressure test every day.
Yeah. Yeah. But I check how many steps I do every day because I try to hit 10,000.
Yeah, I've got it on my watch too.
Yeah. And so when I went to college, I tell my children, handheld calculators didn't even exist. I was using a slide rule, you know, and how silly thinking back. But I went to my 50th college anniversary recently, you know. So we've got a situation now where that transition where we really went into, you know, handheld calculators, microchips, desktop computers became available. The AI is that type of revolution. It's going to just soar us forward. I was speaking at a conference and they asked the question, you know, will AI negatively or positively impact on the markets, you know, people having jobs and things like that. The person next to me, who was way smarter than me, made this really complex answer to all of it. And I said, you know, I honestly don't even understand everything you said. I didn't. But I said, the simple answer is immensely increase the amount of jobs available across. I said, when the first person walked out of a cave and had some kind of a tool to dig a hole, and someone came along with a shovel, it didn't reduce the amount of work to do. They built the pyramids after that.
That's right.
Okay. So that's what's going to happen. AI is going to create a situation where we will get to Mars 5 years earlier than we thought. That's what's going to happen.
Innovation, and right? It's going to enable us to fast forward innovation.
It's just going to drive everything forward.
100%. So from a real economic and value creation, let's talk about like detection, prevention, and perhaps avoided hospitalization. Do you have any idea on that?
Sure. So the earlier we can detect something, and voice is the reason we're called canary speech is it's canary in the coal mine. It's right. An early detection. Like the examples that I gave you, knowing that this young mother doing nothing but good was suffering from depression and you could manage it at that moment, that stayed within the primary care area. And this doctor felt it kept this from becoming a terrible situation. So this was something that was manageable if caught early. This is true of virtually every disease. We know that. And it'll save all of us healthcare dollars to catch things earlier, address them on time, personalize medicine. The more often we're measuring an individual across time linearly, the more we understand and customize or configure those vocal biomarkers for that specific person. It becomes their life history. You know, so, and this is true of everybody's a little bit different, you know, their blood pressure and what their iron levels are, everything. Well, now we have very non-intrusive ways of measuring a whole bunch of things that can become part of how we manage our personal health and how our clinician interacts with us to better coach us on managing our health.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Now, I know you meet with executive healthcare executives on a regular basis. In your opinion, what is the biggest myth that you think that AI is being sold to for the healthcare providers and the executives are thinking about it right now?
You know, there are so many things.
Are they thinking about it the right way in general?
Yes, they are. First off, honestly, they're very smart people. Plus, they have an array of information in front of them all the time. And they have a lot of people that are talking, they're talking to. Good leadership are good listeners, as you know. And so the one thing AI is never going to replace, in my opinion, ever replace, is this personal relationship that we have with our clinician. There are a lot of AI avatars that are interacting with people, and they do in an administrative way, and they do in other ways. But administratively, they can help them set up appointments, they can answer things. But we've been using avatars, vocal avatars, forever. And all you have to do is call any one of the major companies and you get an answering system that is filtering your ability to get to a person, you know, which personally I find irritating. And I think 99% of the population does. So there's a desire to use AI to improve efficiencies. I have often felt that the AI that we have has its primary job is to be non-intrusive, providing expanding information that's available in real time to a clinical team member, but without intruding. And I think I think good AI is going to prove to be that. Now, there's all kinds of AI that go in and scrub large language models and provide information about the last 200,000 patients we saw and how that correlates with the person in front of you. That's kind of like, that's a subjective piece of information because it's not directly related necessarily to the person in front of you. Canary speech is nice because it's looking at that person's vocal biomarkers specifically and answering and providing information about that individual. When you put those two things together, you enhance the information that a doctor or a clinical team member gets. So I think we're going to see that expanding. Multimodal interactions will expand. Mm-hmm. But these are bright people, and they're cautious, which sometimes adoption seems slower than it should be. But this is something that is going to help, I think, both our patients and our clinicians. It'll help with burnout. It'll help address, you know, better decision making. Success has a way of building its own justification, you know.
That's right. I got a couple more questions because we're coming up to time here. Just looking down the road, I guess, for you, Henry, and for your team, First, I never asked you this question. How big is your company? How big is Canary?
So Canary right now, it's about 40 individuals. We're going to expand a little bit this year because we're rolling out with a number of different large institutions. Microsoft, I mentioned. Zoom, I mentioned. We do a lot of work with Samsung as well, LG. Mm-hmm. We're working with major hospitals around the world. We have 16 ongoing development projects. So about half of our company are speech and language scientists and engineers. So, and then the other half is what we do, administrative, help customers deploy products, commercialize, things like that. So we're growing. I think the challenges in front of us are, you know, doing that growth in a manner that you want to succeed everywhere. You know, you don't want...
You don't want to drop the ball, right? So you want to make sure that everything gets on the ball.
And so we do a lot of rollouts in stages, you know, rather than you don't go in and, but you don't do that with any piece of new medical equipment. You go in and you validate it, you train people, they become comfortable with it. It's augmenting a previous technology. It's enhancing your ability to do your job. That's what we're looking for.
100%. So over the long term, what are you building Canary Speech to become?
Well, Canary, what we want to do, I mean, the long vision is to provide objective, actionable information to clinical teams, regardless of where a person is in the world. So if that happens to be in their clinic, that happens to be in their offices, in the four walls of their medical center, that's fine. That's good. But we want to be an assessment that provides earlier information earlier in the disease state to allow individuals to be treated earlier in the process, and then to do it regardless of where they are in the world. So we're doing things in remote populations in Ireland and remote populations in Saudi Arabia, you know, remote workers, if you will. So we want to be able to build an entire platform like a blood profile that you could have a voice profile, and that you pick and choose what you need to know at the moment you're working with or meeting with a patient.
Absolutely. Now, as we wrap it up here, wrap this conversation, which I could talk to you for hours. This is such a fascinating topic, Henry, and the work that you guys are doing is on the leading edge of discovery. You guys are scoring discoveries on a daily basis, it seems. You got a lot of scientists trying to solve big problems, which is kudos to you and to your team. If people were listening to us right now and were to remember, or you would ask them to remember maybe a couple of items out of this conversation, what would you like them to remember?
Well, we're a clinical decision support. What we are trying to do is to provide an additional tool in the toolbox of a clinical team to enhance their engagement, involvement, and the information they have for doing an assessment and a diagnosis of a patient. We're just one piece of that. Mm-hmm. The other thing I'd like them to know is that healthcare is something that we want to enhance, we want to improve, and we're never going to have, from the population to number of doctors and nurses, we're never going to get a better ratio than we have today. It's only going to get worse. And so we have to engage tools that are force multipliers, that provide the ability of that individual, without burning out, to be more effective, more efficient, more accurate, more timely. All of those things come from having actionable information available to them while they're still meeting with the patient.
Absolutely. Now, I want to thank you, Henry. This is so fascinating. This is a great conversation we've had today. I want to thank you for joining me today. I really appreciate it. Any last comments before we wrap it up?
It's such a pleasure to speak to you, Robin. Thank you.
I really enjoyed it. Thank you so much for such an informative conversation. I feel like much more educated now after our conversation. I'm 100% certain our audience is at the same time getting a lot of good information out of this conversation. So I want to thank you, Henry, for joining me. I really appreciate it. And my best to you and to your team. I wish you lots of good stuff in 2026. Happy New Year to you and to your team. And for our audience, I want to thank you so much for following us on this conversation. If you're coming on YouTube, thank you for watching us. If you're coming on the podcast channels of your favorite, thanks for listening in. And I really appreciate it. And thanks for making the Localization Fireside Chat such a success. Recently, I found out that we're closing in on 1,200 downloads per day. And we almost have 2.5 million viewers out there. So thank you so much for being part of the community that we created almost 2.5 years ago. So thanks so much. And I'll see you at the next episode. Thanks, Henry.
Thank you.